As part of the ETC development track, the goal of this session is to provide a framework for working through change, discuss tools for influencing behavior, and give examples of how to increase commitment to your institution. Not only will you leave with actionable items, but at the end of this plenary, some of you will also leave with a wonderful gift from our generous sponsors. So you do want to stay till the very end. And our sponsors today for the session are UK Countryside Tours and Go Ahead Tours. And first, we have a video from UK Countryside Tours.
I want you to join me on a journey back through time into the rich culture and heritage of England.
It's a fascinating story.
I want to take you on a journey
into the English country house, to where taste was cultivated in the most glorious surroundings.
From the plethora of scholars, artists, writers and thinkers that have walked on the ancient streets of Oxford, to the Gothic splendour of Windsor Castle, England's history is etched into its landscape.
You'll find out how a small corner of northwest England dominated global manufactures. You'll meet the objects and ideas that powered England's rich history of invention and discovery, like the first electronic stored program computer.
There are so many treasures in the art collections around English country houses that come from Italy or France. And then in the 18th century, we have our own generations of landscape artists.
When you come to my home here at Chatsworth, you will find hundreds of years of acquisition. My family have been lucky enough to live here for 15 generations, and each one of those generations has left its mark in some way or another.
The walled garden at Gravetye Manor was created by the Irish writer William Robinson, who perfected fruit, vegetable and flower growth.
The stories that we can tell you from these landscapes are really worth hearing.
I want you to join me on a journey.
And now I would like to introduce Brittany Everett and Chris Gentile of Go Ahead Tours.
Thank you, Christina, and good afternoon. Go Ahead Tours is a division of EF Education First, and I'll tell you a little bit about EF in a second, but first let me start with a story. Over 50 years ago, there was a Swedish man named Bertel Holt. Bertel suffered from dyslexia, and he didn't take very well to traditional classroom-based learning. So after high school, he went from Sweden to London, got a job at a bank, and ran odd jobs, like getting coffee, filing paperwork, etc. What he took back with him when he went back to Sweden was how quickly he learned to pick up English. Out of that, in his university dorm room, he founded EF English First, where he sent Swedish students to London, primarily, to study English. Fast forward 50 years, and we have over 14 products to select from for learning. We still share Bertel's one mission, and that's to open the world through education.
So we're all here at ETC for the same reason. We love to travel, we love exploring new cultures, and we love learning. and we're passionate about sharing this with other people. So breaking down barriers and opening the world through education is something that at EF we take really seriously, and that's why it's our main mission today. So although the International Language School is still very prevalent at EF today, we have 13 additional divisions that we've implemented, including our MBA program at Holt Business School, which has over 130 different nationalities. We're the official language sponsor of the Olympics and proud to say that we have been for the past 13 years. So actually this past summer we were able to teach over 1 million people from Rio English. And then we have our travel division. So that's where Go Ahead Tours comes into play. And Go Ahead Tours was designed in effort to continue lifelong learning.
Having been in business for 52 years, we're quite a global company with over 50 offices in 53 countries. We have a 24/7 emergency support system across our 14 EF divisions and over 43,000 staff, all fulfilling one global mission, and that's to open the world through education. We believe that you all here today are sharing that same mission with us, so we invite you to come chat with us at the International Bazaar next door. Thank you.
All right, and now on to our speaker. Art Markman is deeply interested in how to take the science of psychology and translate it into tools that people can use to be more effective in their jobs. He uses research on motivation to help understand how to influence the behavior of other people. He is professor of psychology and marketing at the University of Texas at Austin, where he runs and is the founding director of the program in the Human Dimensions of Organizations, which brings together the humanities and the social and behavioral sciences to teach people in business, government, nonprofits, and the military about people. They run an executive master's program, a bachelor's program, and one-day seminars. He's written over 150 papers on topics including reasoning, decision-making, problem-solving, and how we learn. He served as the executive editor of the scientific journal Cognitive Science for 9 years. He currently blogs for Psychology Today, Fast Company, and Inc. Along with Bob Duke, Art also co-hosts the popular radio show and podcast Two Guys on Your Head, a weekly segment that focuses on a variety of topics in psychology and treats them with plain language and a light heart. Art has written several books, including Smart Thinking, Smart Change, and Habits of Leadership. His latest book, written with his podcast co-host Bob Duke, is called Brain Briefs. He's on the scientific advisory boards of the Dr. Oz Show and the Dr. Phil Show, and he has been on Dr. Phil 3 times to promote his books. Art is also a musician and plays saxophone in a ska band called Phineas Gage, named after possibly history's most infamous brain injury survivor. Please join me in welcoming Art Markman.
All right, how's everybody doing today? All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about behavior change, both in ourselves and in other people. And because it turns out if you're trying to influence other people, it is exactly as hard to do that as it is to change your own behavior. So let me start by just asking a couple of questions. How many of you have ever made a New Year's resolution? How many of you have seen that New Year's resolution fail? How many of you have stopped making New Year's resolutions because they never work? Okay, so you know exactly how hard it is to change your behavior. And yet many of you are in the industry, in the business of affecting other people's behavior. And the fascinating thing is, as soon as you switch from trying to affect your own behavior to trying to affect someone else's behavior, you switch from all the hard work you have to do to change your own behavior to messaging. If I could just find the right message to tell somebody, somehow that would make them do things differently. And I'm here to tell you, messaging will not work. And if you don't believe me, here's a little story. Let's take the top 10 list from the Judeo-Christian heritage. What is that? The Ten Commandments. Now let's excise a couple of them that have to do with follow this religion rather than that one. Everything else on that list is basically saying do the thing that is right in the long term, not the thing that's right in the short term. That guy who just annoyed you, don't kill him. That very pretty thing somebody else owns, don't steal it. The very attractive person married to your neighbor, leave him or her alone. These things are on the list not because they're easy, but because they're hard. The human brain wants to do the thing that feels right now. And according to the story that surrounds the Ten Commandments, the almighty, omnipotent, omniscient deity came down and gave these commandments to humanity in the best-selling book of all time. And the commandments are a failure. Humanity still does all of the things on that list. Now, I'd like to point out that if God cannot come down and say, do this, and have people listen, what makes anyone in this room think that they will simply tell something to someone and that will change their behavior? Okay? You don't have a better vehicle for delivering a message than that. And you are going to have the same level of success. So it's not about the message. Ultimately, if you want to influence behavior, you need to understand something about motivation, about the factors that drive people to act, and then create tools around that to affect people's behavior. And those of you in this room have an added challenge, because not only are you trying to affect people's behavior, but you are trying to do it in the context of establishing a relationship with them. So in many situations, people who are in business couldn't really care less about how close they get to the people that they serve. But for many of you, actually, the kinds of relationships that you engage in are paramount. So here's what I want to do today. I want to talk to you a little bit about the way the human motivation system works. I'm going to use that to help you to develop a set of tools that you can use to influence the behavior of other people. And along the way, you might learn some things that help you to change your own behavior. And in that context, we're also going to talk about the kinds of relationships that you engage in and how those relationships should be developed to influence the way that people interact with you. So that's what we're going to do over the time that we have together. Okay, let's get started. Motivation. The human motivational system involves circuits in your brain. I don't know how many of you have ever seen a brain before. Brain kind of looks like a pair of boxing gloves set the wrong way around, thumb on the outside, bumpier than your typical boxing glove, big fingers on the end there. The brain is gray in color on the outside, so neuroscientists cleverly call that gray matter. There you go, you're a neuroscientist already. If you dig into the brain a little bit, a couple of millimeters down, your brain goes from being gray in color to being white in color. Neuroscientists call that white matter. There you go. And that white matter is actually, it's largely insulation on nerve fibers. It actually, if you think about the wiring harnesses you might see if you opened up a piece of stereo equipment that carry electricity from one circuit board to another, your brain has wiring harnesses too, that where there are neurons that carry information from one area of the brain to another, and they're insulated just like the wires in a stereo, but because nobody's going to be looking at them, they can all be white. They don't have to be color-coded. Okay, so you keep digging in the brain now. It's white in color. You get way deep inside the brain, and you find additional gray matter deep inside the brain. Those brain structures, which are part of an area called the basal ganglia, are part of a brain circuit that has two important functions. The first is that it engages your goals and it drives you to act. It helps you to notice things in your environment that are going to be relevant to achieving your goals. We're talking in the workshop that I did this morning about the observation that many of you may have had that if you ever go shopping for a new car, immediately you begin to notice all the people on the road driving that same car, right? Because your motivational system is now attuned to information that will be helpful for achieving your goal. So these circuits engage your goals, they drive you to act, and they also help you to develop habits. Habits are actually memories. You are learning to relate the situation that you're in to the action you're going to perform. And when you are faster to retrieve the information about what to do than you are to think about what to do, that's when you have a habit. And your brain is constantly looking for opportunities to create these habits. Now, this system that drives you to act is a system that I call the go system because its primary function is to get you to do things. Now, every once in a while, you engage a goal you no longer want to perform. Let's say that you've decided that you'd like to get a little bit more physically fit this year and you're going to try and lose some weight. And so now all of that food that you've been eating before is something you no longer want to eat. For example, I lost about 40 pounds about 15 years ago, in part because I had a love affair with that single-serving carton of Ben and Jerry's ice cream. They're like a pint, you know these? They're in your freezer, you take it out with a spoon, you sit down on the sofa, you eat. You get about halfway down, you take one more spoonful past halfway, and then it's simply impolite to put the rest back in the freezer. And so you consume the entire thing and realize as you look at these so-called nutrition information that you've eaten more calories than some small nations get in a week. So if you no longer want to do this, what is it that stands between you and that Ben and Jerry's? Well, it turns out the only thing standing between you and the ice cream is a little brain region up in above your eyes called the orbitofrontal cortex, which is in the fingers of that boxing glove, which is part of a circuit that inhibits or stops behaviors that the go system has suggested you perform. And so I call that system the stop system. Now, the thing about the go system and the stop system is that the go system is extraordinarily well set up. It has millions of years of evolutionary history behind it, and it's very efficient because we share those brain regions with, if you look at the brains of rats and mice and deer, they all have these brain regions as well. Where the human brain differs from the brains of other animals is in the frontal lobes. Those frontal lobes are extraordinarily well developed in humans, but they don't have as much evolutionary history behind them, and they are much less efficient. And so your stop system is impaired easily. It is impaired by stress, by drugs and alcohol, by overuse. If you've ever seen the movie Airplane, anybody? Lloyd Bridges plays this character. He's under a lot of stress the whole movie because he's trying to talk this guy down, landing a plane. And he spends the whole movie saying things like, I picked the wrong week to stop smoking. By the end of the movie, it's, I picked the wrong week to stop sniffing glue. Why? Because he's showing the effects of stress on the stop system. That's really what he's doing. Okay, so what does this mean? It means that when you want to influence behavior or when you want to change behavior of your own, what you are trying to do is to reprogram that go system. You don't want to ride the brakes all the time. What you really want to do is to find a way to develop new habits and to reorient that go system towards the actions you'd like people to perform. That is the fundamental principle behind affecting behavior, your own and other people's. And so what I'd like to do is to talk about several tools that you can use to change behavior. But before I do that, I want to place this in a context that is very important for the situation that you find yourselves in. Because what you have to remember is that you are in a business of engaging and creating and maintaining relationships with people. And so your attempts to change behavior and influence behavior have to be done in the context of the relationships that you are creating. In particular, sociologists point out that there are three major kinds of relationships that people engage in. I like to call them neighbors, family, and strangers. Strangers are most of the people that you encounter in your life. They're people you don't know very well, you don't have much of a relationship, and you don't have a tremendous amount of trust with them. And so when you engage in a transaction with a stranger, it is fee for service, cash on the barrel right now. When you go into the grocery store and you want to buy a dozen eggs, you have to pay for those eggs right now. You can't borrow a dozen eggs from the store and say, I'll come back and bring you something later. Okay? On the extreme other end is family. Family are the people that you engage in lots of rituals with, lots of discussions with. You celebrate birthdays and holidays. You call. And family do anything for each other. With transactions with family, you don't really pay attention. Parents do and do and do and do for their kids and never give them a bill. Parents hope that someday their children will do and do and do for them as well, right? And every family, as I like to point out, has a ne'er-do-well uncle who has never managed to get his life together, and he's sort of the butt of family jokes, but everybody takes care of him and slips him some money, right? And I always tell people, if you can't figure out who that is in your family, it could be you. In the middle between family and strangers are neighbors. Neighbors are people that you do engage with. You have conversations, maybe you share a few rituals, you've developed some trust with them. And neighbors have a different kind of transaction with them. You settle up with your neighbors in the long term. So in fact, if you're making a recipe and you need a couple of eggs in the middle of the recipe and you find you don't have them, you could run to your neighbor's house and borrow a couple of eggs. You wouldn't immediately pull out your wallet and pay for them. You would just borrow them and then bring a slice of cake over later or drive your neighbor's kids to school or something like that. Neighbors settle up in the long term, but they do have to settle up, because if you don't settle up, then you get ostracized from the neighborhood, right? So people are paying attention. They're just not paying attention in the moment. And the reason this matters is because each of you has to decide, what is the nature of the relationship that I am trying to develop with the people that I work with and with the people that I serve? Now, many workplaces function most effectively as a neighborhood. It's best if there's a certain degree of trust and if people work together to achieve long-term goals. Not just within a workplace, but even across companies, it's valuable to have other organizations that also feel like they're part of a global neighborhood. However, for many of you, particularly those of you who are in the development world, you actually are not trying to create neighbors. You're trying to create family. Because after all, the amounts of money that you want people ultimately to give are not fee-for-service transactions, and you will never really settle up in the long term with these people. What you want is for people to feel so deeply entwined in the family that you've created that they are willing to support you above and beyond what they themselves are going to get out of this experience. Which means that when you engage in attempts to change behavior, you need to be thinking about, how do the things that I am doing affect the kind of relationship I'm trying to create? So, for example, if you are an organization that's trying to create family, and then you engage in lots of fee-for-service transactions with those family members, what are you doing to that relationship? Are you really keeping them in the family, or are you actually subtly and without necessarily thinking about it, pushing them more towards a relationship of being strangers? So I think it's important, as you begin to think about influencing behavior, that you also take the nature of the relationship into account. Now, how can we reprogram that GO system? Well, it turns out that there are 5 tools that you can use to do this. The first is that you have to get the goals right. When you set out to change behavior, you often make an explicit statement about what you'd like to accomplish, and often you fail at that moment. And you fail for 2 reasons. The first is because many times you set goals that are negative rather than positive. By negative, I don't mean downers or sad. I mean actions you're not going to perform rather than actions you are going to perform. And it turns out the GO system can only learn to do things. It can't learn not to do things, which means that if you set yourself a negative goal, you are basically telling the stop system to do all the work, and the brakes will eventually fail. So what you need to do is to think about, what specific actions do I want to take, and do I want the people I'm trying to influence to take? Focus on actions rather than inactions. And secondly, you want to focus primarily not on outcomes, but on processes. Because all of us are interested in creating sustainable change. Almost anyone can reach a particular goal for a short period of time if it's necessary. I have a friend, for example, who, when she got married, her mother said, "I am going to be a thin mother of the bride." And I'll tell you, she was. She, over the 6-month period before the wedding, really basically starved herself and got herself down to the point where she was an extraordinarily thin mother of the bride, but she was not a thin mother-in-law, okay? Because she couldn't sustain that behavior for the long term. And for many of us, particularly when we're trying to affect other people's behavior, we're not trying to get somebody to purchase something from us once, to donate to us once. Organizations survive because people engage with us over the long term, which means we don't want to focus on particular outcomes. We want to create goals that are focused on processes by which people live their lives, whereas a side effect of that process, they do the things that we would like them to do. So we have to think about what are the ways, for example, that we can engage with donors, where as a side effect of this long-term set of interactions, we also get some of the donations we're looking for. Now, that doesn't mean never make an ask to people, but it means that the primary thing that we're doing is maintaining a relationship, developing a process for engaging, and then using that in the long term to help to create the outcome that we desire. So we got to get the goals right. The second thing that we need to do is to develop a really good plan, because it turns out you can't achieve any of your goals unless you take that from being a general statement of what you'd like to accomplish to a very specific set of actions, because people can't do general things. We can't raise a lot of money. We have to get individual donations. I have friends who tell me, I want to write a book. You can't just go, book. Would that you could, but you can't. It's a very specific set of actions that often, by the way, involves many more elements than people think. It's not just writing a lot, and it's, you know, it's also organizing what you've written, and it's also doing research, but it's also learning how to promote the work that you've done so that someone might read it after you've finished. And you don't even begin to figure out what all of those things are until you generate a really good plan. Psychologists call these implementation intentions. An implementation intention is a specific plan that mentions particular locations, particular times. And the reason that you do this is because until you make a specific plan, you don't even know when to do the thing that you're going to do. And you also don't know all of the things that are going to conflict with the creation of this plan. So if you are trying to help somebody to change their behavior, to influence their behavior, this means, first of all, you need to understand what they're doing now. How well do you understand the people that you serve? How well do you understand the things that they're doing? And it turns out you can't just ask them, because most of what we do in our lives, we do by habit, and we are blissfully unaware of many of the things that we do habitually. And so you can't just ask people. I'll give you an example. Exhibit A, I have fingernails. Maybe hard to see, but I promise I have fingernails. Why is this important? Because from the age of 5 until I was in graduate school, I bit my nails. Now, when I finally, and I must admit, for years, my mom, I wish she'd read my book, because, wish I'd written it by then, because she would tell me, stop biting your nails. And I would bite them. And she would paint my fingers with this hot pepper stuff, and it didn't work, but I like spicy food now, so thanks for that. But finally, when I decided it was time to try to stop biting my nails, I realized I didn't know when I was doing it. That I knew that they were bitten because I could see that they were bitten, but I didn't know when. And so for 2 weeks, all I did was watch myself. And I realized I would bite my nails while sitting at my desk reading. And so I started buying desk toys. First thing I bought was a Slinky, you know, the big spring thing. And the reason I got a Slinky is because it's very hard to bite your nails while you're playing with a Slinky, right? And now I'm addicted to desk toys. But I have nails, so I'm good with this, okay? Now, what's important here is you can't even begin to influence anyone's behavior, your own or somebody else's, until you understand what they're doing. Which means that if you're trying to affect what people you serve are doing, you need to know what they're doing now that is conflicting with them doing what you'd like them to do. And that is your starting point for developing a plan. Once you develop that plan, now you need to create a plan that is specific enough that it can be implemented, because only then, A, do you realize all the steps you need to take, and B, do you figure out when they could possibly happen. Because I will tell you something, the when you ask somebody, how are you doing, what do they say? Then at work, they don't say fine, they say busy, right? That's what people say these days, I'm busy. What does that mean? It means I got no time to do anything because I'm busy, okay? So, and everyone's schedules are packed, they're jam-packed full of stuff, which means that if you need somebody to do something for you, you've got to worm your way into a schedule that has no white space in it. And until you begin to get to a plan that is specific enough that it can end up on somebody's calendar, you can't figure out what it is that is conflicting with what you'd like them to do right now that is causing them not to do it. And this is really hard to do. And the reason it's really hard to do is because, in general, most of us plan very abstractly, but we live very specific lives. We plan abstractly because the things we plan to do are off into the future, and it's easy to assume that you will have time to do something in the future, when in fact, when the time comes, you realize you don't have time. And this is because psychologists have demonstrated that the further away you are from anything in time, in space, or socially, the more abstractly you think about it. I was talking about this earlier in my workshop, but we can use this as an example. How many of you planned to come to this conference a couple of months ago? How many of you were totally stoked to come to this conference a few months ago because you knew how much fun you were going to have, how much you were going to learn? It seemed like it was going to be great. And then how many of you on Friday of last week asked yourself, why in the world did I decide to go to this conference? I don't have the time for this. I have too much to do. Do you think you couldn't have predicted several months ago how busy you were going to be on that Monday? You could have predicted it, but from a distance it was abstract. And so you just thought, I'll figure it out. Then when you got close, you realized all the things that were conflicting with it. Well, if you want the people you serve to change their behavior and to engage some new action they're not doing right now, you can't think about this abstractly. You need to think about it specifically so that it ends up specifically on someone's calendar, specifically in their lives. Because if a specific action never happens, they never do anything to engage with you. So we need to create specific plans that refer to specific times of day, specific things that people will do. So we got to get our goals right. We got to get our plans right. The next thing we need to do is to beware of the temptations. Not the music group, I'm a fan. The temptations are the things that will leap out at you to get you to do what you were doing last time. You've experienced temptations in your general life, I'm sure, if you were trying to lose weight and then there was a food that called out to you, or if you were trying to exercise and the couch called out to you. Okay, so you're aware of these kinds of temptations, but even in the people that you work with, there are temptations. The temptations are to give money to the places that they've always been giving. The temptations are to continue doing the same kinds of things that they've been doing in the past. The temptations are to not take your phone calls, right, rather than getting on the phone knowing that ultimately they might be asked for something. And so you have to be aware of those obstacles. And what that means is you have to learn to make use of your finely honed ability to talk yourself out of doing stuff. Each of us, how many of you have ever done that? You have this idea, something you'd like to do, and then you manage to convince yourself all the reasons it won't work? Okay? It turns out that ability is really important. Because what you need to do is to find all of the reasons why the plan that you have created is not going to work, and then figure out how to get around those. You need to develop a plan to figure out how to deal with all of the temptations and all of the obstacles that are going to come out in front of you. Let me give you an example from personal life. There was a big buffet out there before, I saw. And those are the bane of anyone who's trying to watch what they eat, because they put mountains of really good-looking food right out in front of you. So what I tell people is, if you wait until the moment that the buffet appears, you are virtually guaranteed to fail, because it's sort of like going to a party. Temptations are like that person who has the really good zinger that they give to you, you know, that really great line at your expense, and in the moment you're like, And then as you're leaving the party, you think of the great comeback and you wish you could zip yourself back in time to say that great thing. Well, it turns out that temptation is the same way. If you face that buffet line without a plan, you just give in, right? And then later you think, oh, I should have done something about that. But if you plan in advance, then you have that zinger ready to go before it hits you. So, for example, at the buffet, what I tell everybody here is go to the dessert table first, not because you want to eat dessert first, but because that's where they keep the little plates. So grab a little plate. Then bring your little plate to the area where everyone's sitting and reserve your seat while everyone else gets on the line. Now, by the time you get to the front, to the line, you're on a very long line, and you get to the front and all the good food's been picked over already, so it doesn't look as appetizing. You fill your little plate. Now you walk back to your seat and you eat. By the time you're finished eating, they've cleared the buffet away, and you've survived another buffet. The main thing to realize about this is that you are planning in advance rather than waiting for that obstacle to take you down. And that is the way that you deal with temptations, which means that when you're dealing with the people you serve, you need to help them to understand all of the reasons why they won't do the thing that they may have committed to do, the thing that they might want to do, and then help them to deal with that by giving them a plan and by giving them your assistance. Okay, so we've got a plan, we've got goals, we've got a good plan. We have to learn to deal with the temptations. The next thing we need to learn to do is to manage the environment. Most of us do not realize how strongly the environment influences our behavior. But in fact, the human body wants to do things that are particularly easy for it, which means we will do whatever the environment allows us to do. And that means that when you want to change behavior, you want to make desirable behaviors easy and undesirable behaviors hard. It's a very simple principle, but it's extraordinarily powerful. I tell companies that if you want to increase the overall physical fitness of the people who work for you, slow the elevators down. You're still in compliance with ADA, but people are not willing to wait that extra 15 or 30 seconds for the elevator to come, and they will take the stairs to go a few flights. Okay? So what you want to think about is, how can you get into people's environments in ways that will make it easier for them to deal with you? How can you provide consistent reminders that you exist and then make it easy for people to reach out to you when they need you? How can you help people to be connected to you? This is the value of the T-shirt, right? Or, you know, we were talking earlier today in the workshop session. Why do universities, generally speaking, pick some of the ugliest colors known to mankind to use? And the reason is because they are distinctive, and you are making people make a commitment by wearing those. I teach at the University of Texas at Austin. Burnt orange is one of the 5 ugliest colors ever created. And yet, I have a tremendous amount of it in my wardrobe now. And I wear it with pride. And when I wear it, other people recognize me as being part of the same tribe. It is in my environment, I wear it, and it increases my sense of connection to the university. It is amazing how powerful those symbols are. And what we know from psychology is that there is an escalation of commitment. Getting people to do a very small action that they're willing to do increases their likelihood of doing another action that they might be less willing to. Almost anyone is willing to accept a T-shirt, and if it's in their school colors, even to wear it. But that increases the likelihood that they will also open an email later, or a mail, or maybe even send a small check, and that builds on itself. So having these distinctive ways of getting in people's environments affects the behaviors that they engage in. And then the very last thing that you need to do is to make good use of the people in the world. Now, we need to think about people in 2 ways. The first is that human beings need to learn how to act in situations. Human beings come equipped with remarkably little built-in knowledge. So I live in Austin, Texas. My neighborhood used to be overrun by deer, and then I moved to another neighborhood. We didn't get rid of the deer. But the neighborhood was overrun by deer, and I had a baby deer born on my front yard, and it was adorable. It popped out of its mom. Within 24 hours, it had stood up and bounded off, and within a year, it was a fine, upstanding member of the deer community. I have three children, boys. Two of them are in their early 20s, and they are just barely becoming fine, upstanding members of our community. Why was a baby deer able to be a productive member of society in a year, and my kids have required 2 decades to reach the same point? And the answer is because deer are stupid. They come equipped with by evolution to do certain things like eat plants and run away from predators. They have a hard time dealing with crossing the street, and they don't know how to use the supermarket when food is scarce. My kids are able to deal with the information environment as it is in the modern world, even though it bears no resemblance whatsoever to whatever our evolutionary environment looked like. But the cost of that is decades of training, because human beings have to learn how to do almost anything. And that means that if there's something we want people to do for us, we have to teach them to do it. They simply will not know how to do it all on their own, which means we need to make visible members of the community who are doing the things that we already want to do as people who can be followed, because there is a phenomenon called goal contagion. Goal contagion says that when you see somebody doing something, it makes you more likely to want to do it yourself. So, for example, several years ago, I had come to give a talk like this one. And after the talk, I had a box of books I was carrying, and I had my my bag, and I had some papers on top of that, and then I had something else, and I got on an escalator like this. And the inevitable happened about halfway down the escalator. Something shifted, and then I moved, and the next thing I knew, whoosh, everything had come out of the boxes. Now, the fascinating thing was that a guy standing in the lobby in a suit saw what had happened and rushed to the bottom of the escalator to help me clean up all the stuff that was falling to the bottom. And suddenly, 6 or 8 other people walked by, and by the time I got to the bottom of the escalator, there was a whole crowd picking up everything that had fallen. Now, the first person, I don't know what his motivation was to help, but everybody else helped because the first guy was helping. They just did it. They didn't think about it. The goal to help was contagious. Which means that we need to make people in our community who are doing what we think is a good behavior visible to others. This is why big fundraisers work so well. The gala, where everyone's out there pulling out a check and writing stuff. Now you're like, I guess I got to pull a check out, right? Because you're seeing everyone doing that. But what you want to do is to help to teach people the right thing to do, to make desirable behaviors visible, and to provide mentors for people to help them to learn desirable behaviors. We cannot simply expect that everyone will know how to do things. We have to teach them to do things. And that teaching is just a fundamental part of the way that humans are set up. And so we need to create programs in which people learn the desirable behaviors for a community. And the beauty of that learning process is that when you learn from someone else, you also feel more socially connected to them. So it reinforces that ability to bring people into your neighborhood or to bring people into your family if that's the kind of relationship that you want to create. Because ultimately, if you are going to try to influence the behavior of other people, you have to understand that that influence is exactly as hard as changing your own behavior, that you have to reprogram people's go systems, not allow them to rely on that stop system. So we ultimately have to help people to develop goals that are positive, that refer to actions people can perform. We have to focus on processes by which people live their lives. We have to give people specific plans that refer to particular times of day, that tell them exactly what to do, to be wary of the temptations, the things that are going to leap out to keep them from doing things that you want them to do, to manage that environment, to make desirable behaviors easy, undesirable behaviors hard, and then to help people to engage with their community to perform the behaviors we want them to perform. And this is so important in the environment that you work in, because you have to beware of working at cross purposes. And we were talking this morning about the dangers in universities of trying to treat universities like businesses, which is something that is happening all over the place right now. Businesses are businesses. Universities are communities that create families. And I'll just tell one quick story about this. If any of you follow the University of Texas at Austin, you may know that we had an athletic director who lasted a very brief period of time by the name of Steve Patterson. Steve Patterson came to the university from professional sports, and he was manifestly successful in that arena. He came to the University of Texas, and one of the very first things he did was to triple faculty ticket prices because we were paying much less than the average person was. And it just seemed fair from a business standpoint that the faculty pay the same as everybody else. What Patterson failed to understand was the nature of the relationships that you have with the people within your organization. That the reason that faculty get discounted tickets is because we are part of the broader University of Texas neighborhood. That we are teaching their student athletes. That we are staying late after class sometimes. That we are going out of our way to do things to make the entire community thrive. And so what he did was to take an action that told us, you are not neighbors, you are strangers. And we reacted as strangers would. We stopped doing things for the athletic department. My partner in crime on my radio show and I were asked to do an event for the athletic department, which normally we would have done for free, but we asked for a significant amount of money, and they offered us a third of what we asked for. And we said, you know, faculty used to pay a third of what you were asking for to get into games, so I think we will not take you up on this offer to speak to you. The idea is that when you engage in fee-for-service transactions, then you inadvertently push people into a relationship in which they are strangers to you. Many organizations can't survive in that way. More than anything else, what we need to understand is that the relationships that we have with the people that we serve and the people that we work with have tremendous value. They ultimately affect the bottom line. Unfortunately, every organization has extraordinarily good tools for measuring the money and very poor tools for measuring the people. And so one of the things that we have to do when we want to influence people's behavior is to become better attuned at understanding the behavior of the people around us so that we can use that behavior and those relationships to achieve the goals that we're trying to set out. And with that, I want to thank all of you for hanging out with me a little bit. It's been a lot of fun.
Right. Well, thank you, Art, for such a thought-provoking and fun discussion. I know that many of you would like to learn more from Art coming up, and you can follow him on Twitter at abmarkman. He's on Facebook and LinkedIn. You can also sign up for his podcast, Two Guys on Your Head. He will be in the back there selling and signing books, and you can ask any